Hi there, I'm Kim McGregor, coming to you from Kabi Kabi Lands, Queensland, Australia. And myself and my co-host, Heidi Carroll. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Kim.
We're delighted today to have Andrew Gibbons with us, all the way from New York. Andrew's known for his skill at teaching people a more precise functional performance, deeper self-awareness, and how to stay safe and strong in life's activities. As an experienced Feldenkrais practitioner, Andrew is sought out by clients ranging from world-class musicians, professional athletes, and people with persistent issues of chronic muscular and joint pain, injury, stiffness, balance, and neurological conditions. He's a Guild-certified Feldenkrais practitioner since 2003. Andrew's also an assistant trainer working in Feldenkrais teacher certification programs, including the Feldenkrais Training Academy in Seattle. He's a trained classical pianist with degrees from Columbia University and the Manhattan School of Music. Since 2008, Andrew's taught the Feldenkrais method for the prestigious Marlborough Music Festival in Marlborough, VT, where he's worked with some of the world's top classical musicians. Welcome, Andrew. It's lovely to have you here today.
Thanks, Kim. Thanks so much for having me. Hi, Heidi. Thank you. Thank you both for having me.
It sounds to me from your very interesting bio that you have a fairly unique approach to the Feldenkrais method. So we're curious to ask you, to you, what is the Feldenkrais method?
Well, it's an efficiency practice. It's a movement practice. I mean, for people that have are not familiar with it, it certainly is in the category of movement practices. People will probably be familiar with yoga or tai chi or any other kind of fitness practice. But I would say that Feldenkrais, more than most, and certainly in its own special way, is really a pursuit of efficiency. And the efficiency that you're after, or that you're gaining through the method, doesn't just come in physical form, but it also comes through your ability to actually sense your own movement, to predict it better, to support it better, to reverse it when necessary. All of these kinds of elements are part of what it means to move with efficiency. Now, I think when some people hear the word efficiency, they contract a little bit inside because they're a little worried that, oh my God, I'm going to have to become efficient. I'm going to have to perform better. And they see it in those kind of terms. But the really wonderful thing about the method is that it teaches you how to find that efficiency at a pace or at a rate that is really organic to your own ability to learn. And that of course is the emphasis on learning that's often so associated with the method. But I think when people hear about Feldenkrais and the conversation, proceeds a few steps or a few paragraphs in, very often they hear the phrase, that it's about learning, or it's about learning how to learn. And that doesn't make any sense to anybody. That would be as if I said, well, I'm a chef, and you said, well, what do you like to cook? And I say, well, my cooking is about cooking how to cook. And so, I mean, it just very quickly you get into a kind of a verbal snag. We really are interested in how movement works, and how to make the quality of movement clearer, safer, more efficient, smoother, reversible, stronger when necessary. And we're interested in that in a variety of contexts. The Feldenkrais method uses different kinds of positions, different patterns. It is an incredibly rich practice. But I would say that efficiency is really at the top of the list as far as what you're trying, the results that a person is trying to get, right? If a person were going to train with a weight training coach, clearly their goals are going to be what? To get stronger. Right? To get stronger, or maybe the person wants to look, maybe their goals, they're not thinking so much about, competing and getting stronger, but they want to they want to look better. They want to have a certain physique. And that's great. That's great. And if you went to a martial arts class, your interest may be in learning to defend yourself or learning discipline. There are all kinds of ancillary reasons people go into martial arts. But when you're coming to the Feldenkrais method, you really are going to have to look at eventually what it means to become more efficient in the way that you move. And the way you apply that in your life, of course, is really up to you. The method doesn't necessarily say you must apply this in this domain or that domain. Whatever domain is important to you in your life, or whether it's simply you want to walk well into your 80s or 90s, or you spend a lot of time riding a bike and you want to make your bike riding more efficient. For me, it was my interest in the beginning was really to play the piano better, to be more efficient in the way that I moved at the instrument. So there is no single domain in which Feldenkrais is applied as like that's the only place it works for. But it really is an investigation into how to make movement itself safer, more efficient, stronger, all those things.
So you've defined it as the body and the efficiency in the body. Have you seen in your practice how that can then have effects on people's mental ability, their emotional states? Do you think that then that has further ramifications?
I think it does. I think I've certainly seen that in myself and with clients and students over the years. You know, of course, we take it as a kind of a given that the quality of your movement is not somehow divorced from the quality of your sensing, your thinking, the way you're able to orient in space, clearly your proprioception or your interoception. Movement is not just this product, the way that we tend to think about it in terms of sports, you know, like the person's movement was really good. He won the race, right? Well, there are different versions of what really good movement means, of course. And for some people, good movement can be the ability to simply walk up the stairs in a way that's totally elegant and they don't feel like their knee is going to be killing them. But in order to get there, in order to actually improve, the method really teaches you how to exploit the connections between the way that you actually sense your body as you move. You're not going to be able to improve your movement until you really engage with your ability to sense movement. And movement has a lot of aspects to it to sense, all of which can improve the finished product, so to speak. The emotional stuff and the thinking process behind it are also, of course, very important too, because in order for a person to really refine what they do, they need to be in a state with themselves where they're not anxious, where they're not trying to, you know, just force themselves through some process using willpower, or they're just anxiously or nervously or compulsively treating themselves throughout the course of the practice or the lessons. And so all these things are linked together. The container that the method sits in, when I say that it's a practice for efficiency, it really creates a process for a person so that they can investigate what that actually means. Because it doesn't make any sense to just tell someone, okay, I'm going to make you more efficient. Here, do it like this. Move your arm like that. Now, turn your head more. You know, something super directive. That doesn't work, because the person will tend to trip over all sorts of emotional triggers and all sorts of past habits. They'll just be trying to force themselves like toothpaste through a tube. And this is what a lot of people in the fitness world, or the people that want to get more fit, of course, struggle with when they go to try to move themselves in more energetic and athletic ways, is that there's not a very good on-ramp for them. It's like 0 to 60 right now. And Feldenkrais really steps back and says, let's try to create a much smoother, more gradual process so the person can actually be okay with a challenge. They can learn what an appropriate level of challenge is and then apply that over and over, so they're gradually approximating their progress, but they're not tripping over themselves to get there. Yeah.
So, Andrew, what kind of principles or elements do you think are important then when you're teaching your ATM lessons to help people, you know, really sense their body more, to be able to investigate what these things mean that you're talking about?
Well, for me, the word principles really talks about something specific in the method. Like you said, principles and elements. Yeah. And just, you know, to step inside to put my teacher hat on. You know, when I'm teaching an awareness through movement class, awareness through movement is sort of the self-directed, often it's a group lesson where the teacher is verbally directing the students. When I'm teaching awareness through movement, for me, it's very important that the students are actually understanding what let's say a biomechanical principle is. And there are several biomechanical principles that the method really talks about in great detail, and that the lessons are really this vehicle for, again, examining and helping you exploit. For instance, there's a principle of being able to produce an equal and opposite push, right? If I want to, you know, pivot over to my right, I push off of the left foot. So even though my body weight is moving to the right, I'm kind of pushing down into the left with my left foot into the ground to produce that kind of movement. Now, that's a principle that everybody uses all the time, whether they know they are or not, they're using it. The point of the class is to help them see it clearly for maybe the first time in their life, and to see how to make it more deliberate and to sense it with greater clarity than they ever have. Because most people, of course, are just moving in the way that they have in their life because they have a good enough version of moving. We all do this. There are, of course, people who they just have this kind of special DNA and they just move really beautifully. And those people tend to go on and to become the great athletes or dancers or performing artists of the world. You kind of need that to get to those levels. But many of us are just doing what's been good enough for us. And then as we get older, it's not good enough anymore. And we run into these problems. And so what we need is actual training and education to know what are the resources and what are the tools that we have, what's movement really made out of. Because we don't really know. The average person has no idea how they're actually walking down the street and that you can manipulate different elements of the walk in different ways. They only really encounter that kind of conversation if they get injured and they go to a physical therapist or a doctor or a Feldenkrais teacher or somebody else who then helps them see a different point of view and hopefully introduces them to this idea of, well, you're going to need to practice. I'm going to show you this idea, and then you're going to see if you can apply it and then see if it has a positive effect on your situation. But, you know, pushing equal and opposite to create a movement, for some people, this is actually a revelation, not because it's the most amazing thing that they've ever done, I don't think, because it's not. They're doing it all the time. They just don't know that they're doing it. And they don't realize that a little bit of attention to it actually makes a huge difference. You know, there's a funny video of astronauts in outer space in the space station where there's no gravity. And so they're floating around. And oftentimes in class, I can use this story to illustrate to people. You know, those astronauts in the video, it's really fun. They're floating around the space station. You know, they take water, you know, they drink water, and then the water globules, you know, float in the air, and everyone's amazed by the fact that they're in zero gravity. And the thing to realize in those situations is that those astronauts cannot direct themselves to move from one part of the space station to the other. They can't get anywhere unless they push off of a surface. It's incredibly clear to watch a video like that if they're just floating in space, they can move their body. They can flail in space, but they cannot direct themselves in a particular direction until another astronaut floats by and they push off of her, or they get into contact with the wall and they push off of the wall. And it's just a great example for students to realize that here on Earth, gravity is always pulling us towards the ground. And our system, our muscular system and our nervous system is built so that if you want to make a movement, you are generating an equal and opposite force to do that. Now, when people are moving and they don't feel so good, it's often because they're not really using that to their advantage very well. That's one example of a way they can improve.
So when you're teaching your ATM classes, do you feel that the lessons in themselves evoke the opportunity for people to understand that? Or do you feel that there's sort of a teacher responsibility on how the students understand that and how you deliver that message?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a question of pedagogy. I think it's certainly possible for students to participate in awareness through movement class, and the teacher could give very spare instructions. In other words, the teacher could avoid being very explicit with them and just sort of teach the lesson from the point of view of the movements you make. Here you're going to roll the head, then you're going to roll the head with the shoulder, then you're going to, you know, something very something dry and procedural. And even doing that sometimes has a great effect, because there is something both compositional about that kind of teaching, where the students are, of course, learning to compose the movement step by step. There's a sort of a sequential nature, which people ordinarily do not do in their lives, you know. But as far as my take on the way that I teach, I am much more explicit. My stance as a teacher for the students that I work with is that I am going to lead you through the lesson. I'm going to do it hopefully gently and compassionately, but I'm going to make sure that you get what you pay for. You're here to learn how to get the benefits from this practice, not just an experience of the practice. Now, obviously, sometimes I dial that up and sometimes I dial that down. But I'm a great believer in that a person coming to the Feldenkrais method really should have some kind of encounter with the power and the specificity and the breadth and the depth that are in the lessons. And I find it to be both challenging and very satisfying to try to establish a relationship with the students, to lead them well so that they start to lead themselves well too. I've been teaching for about 20 years now, and I've seen enough of students kind of doing the lessons, having some kind of experience that they're not very clear about, that was kind of lovely. They might be positive about it, but they're not very good at digesting it. They don't know what it means. They want more, so they do it. They go for another class, they go for another week, and they kind of string along like this for a long period of time. And yet they don't really improve very much, some of them. And to me, that is a problem for them and for the teacher to solve. And for me at this point in my career, I don't want people to string along. I want them to engage with the material. And part of that means engaging what's between their ears. They have to learn how to pay attention. They have to learn how to engage with the dynamic of the instructional space between the teacher and the students. The teacher is not just sort of dropping movement instructions and saying them in a nice tone of voice and waiting for the students to sort of figure it out. That's kind of a fantasy that some of us have as teachers, that that this method is somehow it's a self-learning, and that does happen. But I also think that people need guidance and people need specificity. And I can bring that, and I often do. So, and the people that come to me, that's what they're coming for.
So you're doing a lot of teaching people how to self-learn, how to be self-aware, how to sense themselves.
I'm very specific.
Yeah.
If you were to gather the 40 people in my class, you know, last Tuesday or whatever it was, they would tell you that I'm very specific. I'm very rigorous with them. I really try to build a very rigorous experiment in the lesson with them. Because you're not just teaching people how to move, but you're really trying to exploit the container, the context that awareness through movement provides. It's an experimental context. And I don't mean experimental like, hey man, it's experimental. Nobody knows what they're doing. And we just kind of just do a little of this. And it's not random. It's really meant to orient the students in the class much more clearly than they've ever been in the way they use their bodies and in the way they use their senses. You know?
Can you give us an example?
An example of being rigorous?
Yeah, yeah. How you might do that. So let's take a classic lesson. I could suggest one, like, you know, pelvic clock or perhaps you've got another idea, and just give a little bit of example of how you help people to engage more with that learning process.
Well, hopefully the audience listening to this is familiar with the pelvic clock lesson, so I'll just assume that they are. And I'll construct a kind of a straw man so that I can give you a straw man that doesn't exist, but the straw man will be a badly taught pelvic clock version, which I may have seen once or 50 times in my career over 20 years. And I may have even done a few of them myself, the bad ones, right?
Sure,
hopefully my understanding of that lesson has evolved over time. In the badly taught versions of that lesson, the teacher does the basics. They teach the students how to roll the pelvis along the sagittal plane, you know, towards the 6 o'clock and the 12 o'clock. And they do it in the 9 o'clock to the 3 o'clock, you know, and then they fill in the other hours and then they do the circle, right? That's sort of the dry what. I mean, I think any basic beginning teacher would know to try to cover that. Now, for more detail, what, you know, students suffer with that lesson sometimes, and they suffer because of the way that they're engaging their musculature to make that movement. For instance, for a lot of people, if you watch a group of students doing that lesson, you will see people moving their pelvises. But do you know the difference between a person that powers the movement of the pelvis from their lower back versus a person that actually knows how to use their hip flexors or their hip extensors? Now, these are to the lay person walking in, you know, your friend says, can I just come watch the class? You know, they're going to see a bunch of people moving their pelvises. And your friend may even see, well, some people, they kind of look like they were stuck, or they looked like they were, you know, struggling. And some people really were elegant, and they really had this kind of, you know, this ability to really smoothly move their pelvis. In the same way that the average person, if you sit on a bench and you watch people in the park, if somebody's limping when they walk by, that person doesn't need to be a doctor or a physical therapist. They can just see, oh, she's limping, right? So by the same token, you could watch this group of people and you would see them all moving their pelvises more or less in the same direction when the teacher says. But to teach the students the difference between, you know, driving the movement from the spine, trying to arch the spine to get the pelvis to roll down towards 6, or flattening the lower back, and not really understanding how to find the power in the actual hip muscles to drive the movement, so that the spine is actually more supple and secondary to the movements. It's sort of like providing a helping mechanism to the real power down in the pelvis. This takes a little knowledge. It takes a little knowledge. Mm-hmm. It takes the teacher to actually have unpacked the lesson for themselves like that. But then it also really requires that you then figure out, how are you going to teach this to people? And it may not happen in one lesson, right? It may happen over a series of lessons. But hopefully an experienced teacher not only knows the difference in how a student might interpret an instruction like roll your pelvis. Roll your pelvis turns out to mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And yes, some people will produce an absolute traffic jam of effort between the way that they contract their abdomen at the same time while they're trying to push with the legs or whatever it might be. And the role of a rigorous teacher or a rigorously taught lesson is to really help them unpack that traffic jam so that they see clearly what the different possibilities are of how a person can roll the pelvis. There are a lot of different ways to get that thing to move, right? And there's a lot of different little ancillary movements and sensory cues to help the person untie that little mystery. And so a really rigorous lesson would step by step show them all these different versions And then also be able to sort of explain a little bit of the anatomy. You don't have to give them obviously a full, you know, you're not gonna put a skeleton up on the screen or muscles up on the screen. You're still gonna walk them through it experientially. But the idea is to really construct the lesson so that they can figure out something about themselves that they will never forget, right? And then to hopefully also when they get up and walk around, to also reinforce what they experienced on the floor, how does that then represent in walking, right? So that the teacher is both giving them time to experience these different versions of how they might move the pelvis, and also really leading the horse to water, right? That's an art, you know, to be able to lead the horse is an art, to be able to know what a horse is an art, to be able to know where water actually exists is good. You can lead the horse to where you thought the water was and then it's not there. You know, these are all levels of understanding what you're doing when you build lessons for the students.
So as a very experienced teacher of over 20 years, what would you say to new practitioners? What hints or tips would you give to new practitioners to allow them to really enhance their teaching?
Well, the first thing I would encourage them to do is teach a lot. Most beginning practitioners are scared. I was scared. Most of us are quite insecure when we come out of the training programs, because the training programs are just teaching you to be a beginner. Right, they're not teaching you to be a full black belt, you know, not that there is such a thing, but you're learning how to be a competent beginner. And a competent beginner, more than anything else, needs to work. They need to teach a lot. And that means they need to somehow attach their love and enthusiasm that they had for the work, that which brought them to it, to an actual program, an actual challenge to actually bring this to other people, and to, you know, to suffer through those beginning years, and to really take seriously the project of refining your understanding day by day. This is very, very important. I was very lucky when I was starting out, because in my training program, I carpooled with somebody who was a physical therapist, and she and her husband were both physical therapists. They are still physical therapists, and her husband also had just gone through the Feldenkrais training program. And I started working with them about halfway through my training program. And so I was very lucky in that I was in an environment where I had colleagues that I could talk to and learn from and practice with. And there was a real culture there. We would teach each other ATMs every week in the office. So, you know, for a lot of beginning practitioners, they have the warm cocoon of the training program, and then you graduate, and then suddenly it's a ghost town and you're by yourself and you don't know what to do. And I didn't want to do that. I knew I really wanted to work with other people. And so that was part of my plan. And it was very effective, because I went to work really every day. And then I had an opportunity to start teaching and teaching classes, and to, again, you have to get out there and work your skills. Otherwise, you're only left with your insecurity. And then you're just nervous about every time you teach, and you're hoping it's going to go well. That is not a great formula. What you need is to work a lot so that you almost get bored. You get bored of the lessons you teach, and then you want to learn other lessons, and then you want to refine those lessons. And what you're bored of is the interpretation that you have of the lesson at that point. And that makes you grow. So a good advice for a beginning practitioner is set yourself up to succeed, which means work, teach a lot, be in business, go give lectures, go give workshops, go give free classes, whatever, you know, don't be shy, I would say.
I completely understand that the more you're out there, the more you learn yourself, it becomes a learning practice. But then there's also those gaps. Like I love the pelvic clock. I've done it lots, but how you explain that then for me, I've found something different in just even the intellect of it, let alone the movement of it. So what does that mean as far as learning, becoming, When we're learning the method through our training and our and people doing advanced trainings, where what do you think that rigor is that's needed for people to understand those subtleties a little bit more to then be able to teach them in a much more clarified way?
Yeah, that's a great question, because part of what happens in the training programs, and of course there are different styles of training programs, different trainers have different kinds of approaches and whatnot. But my take on what a student probably doesn't get enough of in their training is they don't get their questions answered. Not to the degree that they should. And I'm not saying that the trainings are somehow, I'm not criticizing the trainings. It's hard, you're in a group of 50 people or 30 people or whatever your training was. You're in a group and you adapt to being in a group and you adapt to getting a certain level of understanding. You adapt to hiding in your group probably a little more than you should. You find the people that you get along with and you like, and then you sort of stick with that group. And these are all little survival tactics that we all do. But what you really ought to do if you want to get good is you got to get out there and talk to people who know more than you do. And then you got to pay them for their time. This is my honest suggestion, is not to trust what people tell you. The Feldenkrais teachers that are out there are wonderful, but your job is not to take everything for granted. Your job is to go figure out, why don't you understand it the way they do? Or why are you still stuck with your idea of, and you just can't get, you should struggle with that. And the way you struggle is by building a community of colleagues that you can practice with, you can talk to, you can kibitz with, you can share ideas with, and you can test things out. That's the very much the nature of the method, is to be able to test out your ideas. And that's what a emerging practitioner really deserves, is they deserve to work hard and figure out what they don't understand about their ideas. I'll give you an example. When I ended the training program, I was very enthusiastic. But what was really great about my situation was, while I was enthusiastic, I was just beginning. And I was working with people who had several more years of experience than I did, and also had medical training. That was really great. And then when we taught awareness through movement lessons to each other, every week a different person would teach the lesson. And then we would also talk about it afterwards. And sometimes we'd argue about it. That's very healthy. It's very healthy to argue about those things. A lot of the transcripts, we taught from the Alexandria and I transcripts. Sometimes we just went methodically through, I think, we once or twice a week, and we got up through lesson 120 or something like that before we petered out or whatever. But the it's good to sort of have reflections of your teaching in supportive colleagues, obviously, but then also to be able to reflect on your own teaching on your own time. Like when you go home and you're thinking about what you taught, do you just think, oh, that was a good class, I did a really good job? Or do you think, why? Why did I do a good, why did I like that lesson? Or if you taught the lesson and it went kind of badly, why not ask yourself, what did I hate about that? Is there something I actually don't like about that lesson? And then if you go back to the transcript, sometimes you realize, yeah, it's totally unclear to me what he's saying in this part of the lesson. I don't understand. He's getting his left and rights mixed up, maybe in the transcript, or there's like a distraction in the class clearly from the trans. I mean, and this is another important point for practitioners to realize, these are transcripts. It's not a textbook. Those are live transcripts from a class. There's a lot of detail in there you may not understand as a beginner. And there's a lot of detail that's simply not included. And so those lessons really have to be raked over and unpacked and broken and put back together. And that's done in conversation and in collaboration with colleagues. That's where you really learn a lot. Because the tendency, I think, for a lot of young students is just to take everything that has Dr. Feldenkrais's name on it as if it's in amber. And I think this is a mistake, personally. I think some of the lessons could be drastically improved. Some of the lessons are not really lessons because they're not laid out well, because he got distracted by somebody in the room who is having enormous trouble with the very first instruction. And he basically rebuilds the entire lesson for this person throughout the whole. I mean, it's amazing that he did that, but that may not be the model that a young student needs to do for their next class. These are real issues for how a teacher actually learns to get better at their craft, and you have to confront them, because you actually grow very fast when you start to do that. When you get over the fact that the materials are not some sort of textbook, there's a lot hidden in there, and that you have to actually engage with living teachers. I would also recommend that. It's really good not to just read Moshe's books. They're amazing, of course, but you really need to talk to people who are more experienced than you, who can guide you. That's very important. And then you learn who to trust and who you click with and who you don't, and who challenges you too much, and who actually has just the right, you know, amount of salt for your particular phase. And then you can grow, because you're trying to actually understand how this stuff works. And a lot of what you're trying to understand is about not just physical function, which is hard enough. There's a lot of muscles and bones that you will not understand well when you leave the training. You still have a lot of studying to do. But there's other stuff about learning strategies and how constraints actually work. What's a constraint for? Do you really know what a constraint for? Is you just know what a constraint is? What's this constraint for? Why is this constraint in the lesson where you're holding the knee with both hands, and you're rolling and you're holding it with both hands? What's that about? Do you just know it as an instruction in the lesson, that's the third instruction in the lesson, or the 10th? Or do you have a working model of why that particular step is in there, right? And it's okay to not know. This is the other thing. It's really it's important to embrace your ignorance and just to engage with it, because that's how you get better, I would say.
I did one of your lessons this morning, and you said, let the head be used by the instruction of the lesson. Since the head wasn't mentioned, let it stay trapped in its position. So for me, the head wasn't a constraint, but for most people, they didn't have that as a possibility to move. So then you very clearly pointed out what people were possibly doing to then do the opposite. Is that
right? That's the old trick of tell them to do what they're already yeah. doing, right? In other words, several people in the class were trying to make big movements with their legs and their pelvis in the lesson that you did, and yet their head was not involved at all. So rather than say you need to move the head, or please move the head towards the knee, you know, some sort of more explicit directive instruction, you give them permission to not move the head, to keep it glued to the floor. Don't let it, whatever you do, don't let it participate. Now, this is provocative, right? This also wakes up the people that are sleeping through the lesson, so to speak, right? And this is part of the art of being the kind of teacher that can lead people out of their state of torpor or ignorance or whatever it might be. And it's also part of the fun of doing the lessons, which is that you're not just there in some rote script, right? Here's part one, do this, blah, 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 blah. Okay, rest. Here's part two, do that, da, 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 da. Okay, rest. It doesn't have to proceed so pedantically. It's a live situation. And at least for me, when I'm with my students, you better be in that room with me, because I'm definitely in that room with you. And I'm not going to be, you know, mean or insulting or whatever, but I am going to try to perturb you a little bit, so that you really start to participate in the lesson at a higher level than you were a moment ago.
So what I'm hearing from that is you've obviously got the lesson planned out, you've got your own understanding, but then you're very rigorous as far as the observation of your students, and then using the language and what you're seeing to then invoke certain things so that you know that they're getting what you want them to get.
It's kind of a tricky line that we teachers walk, because you have a group of students in the class that are not all pre-qualified. They're all at level 4.5. They're not all yellow belts, or they're not all orange belts, or no one has decided that they all have the perfect same understanding of Feldenkrais at that point. What you have often is a mixture of people who are at very different points in their lives, who might even be in the same class for very different reasons. Someone is coming because their friend told them this really helped them walk better. Another person is coming because they had shoulder pain, and Andrew really helped them with the shoulder pain, and so they thought they would try out the class. So you have a mixture of people in the class. Yes, I have a plan for the lesson. Yes, I have some sort of, you know, ideal for how I want the lesson to go. I also know it will not go that way. I've certainly taught long enough that I know you make a plan, but then the plan never survives the battle, so to speak. So as a teacher, another layer of skill is, of course, to understand the lesson you're teaching, to understand functionally how it works, to understand how the steps in the lesson might get a person there if they don't have too much trouble. But then I also have to have the kind of flexibility and the kind of perception to see who in the class is struggling and to help them, to actually address some of the instructions to maybe not to them personally or by name, but to help them sort out physically, intellectually, attentionally, where they're not paying attention and how to perturb them just a little bit to get them back on track. Now, clearly, if you have a class with 50 people, you could drive yourself nuts doing that because everybody is a little bit off. No, it's not as if you're teaching a choreographed dance class where everybody's all the moves are just time. It doesn't look like that at all. At the same time, there does need to be some rigor. You do want people to all be doing somewhat the same lesson. And the challenge is just to make it fun to include those details and make them beneficial for everybody. I guarantee you the person that maybe caught my eye, whose head was just, you know, not moving at all, I guarantee you that when those instructions are then offered into the class, it's not just that person that says, oh, I can move my head. Other people in the class are listening and paying attention as well, and they're gauging how that instruction lands for them, and they're further refining the level of integration that they have with their head making the movement too. So it's a live situation, you know.
So do you think the way that we teach the method holds the method back? I mean, if I think about, you know, yoga, Pilates, other things that have become very, very popular and very well known, there's still a lot of people, even though the method's been around a long time. I mean, Moshe has been not with us for many decades. You know, what is it? I'm often curious about what it is that people don't know about. A lot of people say Felden, what I haven't heard of that, but is it like Pilates? And yet they know about these other things, but they don't know about the Feldenkrais method. And I'm just wondering, some of those things you've been saying, do you think that's what holds it back? Is it the way we engage or don't engage people?
I think so. I think certainly there are sort of tropes, or there are kind of traditions in, I mean, it's not like I know what kind of teaching goes on all over the, I just know that, you know, I've known the teachers I've known and I've seen the teachers, so I don't mean to overly generalize, but I get the drift of your question. You know, the general approach that Feldenkrais is often offered, the way it's often offered to students is that it's done incredibly gently and incredibly slowly. And there are reasons for this. There are real strategic reasons for this. Again, a mixed group of people, some of whom have injuries. You don't want anybody to get hurt. There's also a real somatic advantage to slowing down, right? To increasing the caliber of your attention by slowing down. And also it enables you to get underneath your habits in a different way that you can't when you're sort of being encouraged to perform or go faster. But I think the mistake is just that the teachers trust the method too much. I don't trust the method. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, every time I walk into a class, I'm not leaning on anything. I mean, yes, I have experience, so I have an idea of how it could go, and I make a plan so that I'm holding the space with as much integrity as I can. But the kind of teaching you might be talking about is the kind where the teacher is just kind of floating through the instructions, which of course can have a wonderful effect. It is one way to teach that can be beautiful, can be very helpful. It can really make the environment safe for people to engage with their bodies when they just do not trust their experience with their bodies. This is what most people are coming to the, I don't know that they would necessarily say this, like, I'm here in the class because I really want to trust myself again. I think that's what a lot of people are coming for, actually. I know I said the method is about, you know, efficiency, and that's one way to describe it. But another way I would say is the method is about helping a person learn to trust their own movement, to trust their own experience of themselves. Yes, I could say in the world, that's a little general, but to really have trust in themselves again in the way that they organize themselves in the world. And I also think it's a big world. I think part of the reason, if you're asking why the method is not more popular, I think that has something to do with it. The world is a chaotic, messy place. People want benefits. They want to perform. I mean, have you been on YouTube lately? The kind of stuff you have access to now, the kinds of people you can see on YouTube who are actually teaching what they do is extraordinary. And the kind of leaning on the past ways of teaching the method, I think, is part of the problem. If the method is going to get more popular, it's our fault if it's not. It's nobody else's fault. I mean, unless somebody drops a bazillion dollars into TV ads and commercials and covers the internet with really well-produced media, okay, that'll have some effect. But are the teachers that are there to take in all that business, are they ready for that? I don't know. Some are, probably. I think the way of describing the method to people needs to become a little richer, a little more. We need to hold our power a little more clearly for people. There are practitioners working with athletic teams, and I work with elite classical musicians every summer. You got to know what you're doing in that environment. Those people are really, they're just like anybody else, and that they have issues with how their bodies work. But you've got to be able to be a pro in those environments. And the conversation about the method, it's important that the conversation, it really talks about the method responsibly, I think, and honestly, talks about what we do well and what's really not in our scope of practice. I think it gets kind of messy sometimes about what we think the method is going to help a person with. That'll shake out in the future somehow. I don't know. But I definitely think the level of conversation has to go up, not down.
Yeah. So you're also talking about, you know, where there's a lot of benefits that are publicly there about what the Feldenkrais method can give you. Like you said, you know, efficiency, ease, grace. I think we talked about, you know, you can actually end up with a new body as a result. But what you're talking about is being more explicit about, okay, when you come to classes, this is what you need to do. It's almost like you're saying you're asking people to make a commitment to that self-learning, that self-knowledge, that self-awareness.
I think so. When people, the something people will definitely get from me as a teacher, like I was saying early to Heidi's question, was like, I'm in there with the room with you. You're going to learn to pay attention. You're going to learn to use your attention quite deliberately. We're going to try and create all the beauty and the pacing that makes that possible. But there's also has to be somewhat of an edge to it too. You've got to be present in the room. This can't be a practice where you are drifting through the lessons and sort of aspirationally thinking, well, I'm doing Feldenkrais. Look how slowly. I mean, that can be a nice experience, But there is part of me that just wants to be, that wants to say, show me the money, you know, like, show me that you really can squat now. Like, let's see you apply this understanding that you got from the lesson. Let's see it in the upright context. That really is in the work.
How do the people in your classes respond to that, do you find?
Well, this is a conversation I'm having, so I'm being kind of emphatic with you. It's not like I'm confrontational like that, that with my students. But certainly, you know, after the class, you know, after the lesson, I usually, in my online course, people will, we stay and talk for half an hour, sometimes an hour. I love talking with the students. That to me is a big part of helping them to contextualize their experience in the lessons. Certainly there are people who come to the class and when it's over, they want to just take private time and be quiet with themselves and really marinate in the experience they had. I totally encourage that. I pause and I say, for those of you that are signing off for the evening, you know, go ahead and see you next time. And I think that's wonderful. But for the students that do want to ask questions and had, they either had something, a difficulty in the lesson, they didn't understand something, or I didn't explain it. I didn't deliver it very clearly. I maybe goofed it at some point or something.
Yeah.
I want to help them over that obstacle. I want to help them explore, and I want them to also understand how it applies maybe in the rest of their life or maybe in their beloved activity. You know, I have somebody in my class who's a choreographer and a dancer in her 60s and who still practices, and it's very important to her. I want her to get it. I want her to get what she paid for. I want her to understand that this quality she has in her right hip finally at the end of this lesson, yes, she should be able to find that at the bar. That should be something that now is part of her compass when she's standing at the bar. And so in that exchange, I mean, you can hear how I am. I'm pretty much like this with my students. I hope it's a positive force for them. But it's really,
it sounds like an ability to me in a way.
Well, I don't think it's very honest, actually, unless that's part of it, because the thing I really don't like, and which kind of reflects back to your other question of like, are we kind of sleeping through the method, or are we just not teaching it with enough precision or whatever? The thing that I don't really like, the same way that I said I don't trust the method, I don't want people to trust the method either, actually. I want them to learn how to trust themselves, right? The method is like a technology. That's what the method is. It's a little piece of software that you can learn how to run. It's very consistent. It's got rules. It's got guardrails. It's got strategies. It's got constraints. It's got little features and preferences you can change. It's just like your piece of software, and you learn to use it. And my God, you can create this amazing experience reliably. But it does take some time. And it takes a practice and it takes discipline. And I don't want people imagining that it's just supposed to happen by magic. Because while I know there is magic, and occasionally you do have these incredible moments of grace, and it really is in the method, those moments are not necessarily the method. And I think it's a mistake to give people that kind of aspiration, that's supposed to be what it is all the time, that you're just supposed to sit there and receive and receive and receive. My God, don't be so passive. Some of these people need to learn how to get after it. They need to apply themselves a little more rigorously, and then they will actually get the benefits that they say that they want. You know, this is another part of just the journey of students and teachers, right? Teacher's job is also to help the student help themselves, right? And the teacher can't have some Pollyanna idea that everybody comes to class and is just healed and cured like a miracle. That's not an honest conversation to me. Not that I'm accusing anyone of doing that. It's just, to me, the rewards that the students seek really come from practice, from discipline, from engaging. And I want them to know that the method, it will return your effort, right? It will really pay you back when the tires start to grab the road a little better, you know?
So the way that you're speaking to me speaks to potency. I mean, I've had that lovely experience where you find more ease in your life, you find more gentleness, you can feel, feel better in your life. But to me, to be truly potent, I want to be able to run and swim harder and lift my weights a bit better as well, to find that vigorousness and that energy.
Right.
And then you're talking about responsibility of how the students then engage with that. So as a teacher, what's your expectation, or how do you get the participants to engage? And then is it about telling them to practice more, or how do you get them to do that?
I mean, there's a practical consideration here. These students that we're talking about, most of them are coming to my bi-weekly ATM classes that I teach online. And then maybe some others are actually, they're not coming to class, they're just doing the recordings from the library in the course, right? They're just sort of they're teaching themselves by using the recordings in the library. And so I may not ever have talked to some of them, right? And some of them have never come to the live classes. It just, they're in Australia, or they're in another part of the world that the time I can teach doesn't work. But that kind of encouragement from me, it comes through in the lesson itself, but it's not like I'm shouting at them like a football coach or something during the lesson. But that kind of encouragement also comes in the discussions after the lesson. Because, and certainly the people that mentor with me privately that are younger practitioners who mentor with me, or people in training programs who have extra time with me and this sort of thing. And there are also, I just have private clients who come for private lessons, but also give them homework from lessons in the course. I am there to help them get what they want. That's what they pay me for, right? Now, of course, everybody has their own pace at which they can learn. But there has to be a balance. It cannot just be that the person is like, well, my back has been, a mess for 10 years, but I really want to be able to go on hikes with my son or whatever. And then they're just this passive pool of pudding all the time. That's not going to work. I cannot just use my hands and somehow give them the function that they have never had. They are going to have to come into the lesson themselves, and I will guide them. And they have to learn how to take over the work in the lesson. They not just me moving them and them being passive, which can be very useful, but then they have to engage and make the movements themselves. And sometimes they have to, I use resistance with them, or I'll use different kinds of constraints. And again, it's all part of engaging them in their own improvement. That part of it is actually super powerful, of course, when it goes well. It's an art to introduce challenge to a student and have it go well. That's something I've been working on for a long time. It's possible to overdo it. It's possible to pick the wrong challenge for the wrong person. It's possible to pick the right challenge for the person. It's just the wrong day to work on that particular, you have to be sensitive as a teacher. But as far as just my DNA, it's good for students to know that I can bring that to the lessons. And, I'm also just listening to see if people are, if they're listening back, if they're ready for that conversation. Not every student is going to be receptive to that part of me. And so I know how to disappear and camouflage that part of myself, because it's useful to be able to do that too. So
it's lovely to hear your passion and your excitement. What are you excited about in terms of the future for the method of yourself, or just the method generally?
Well, I am slowly finding my audience that responds, obviously, to my, that's what every teacher does. I mean, whether they realize it or not, you're going to draw the people to you that are drawn to your particular way. I think a lot of young teachers think they can't wait for people to come because the people like Feldenkrais, because the young teachers, of course, what we want when we're young and inexperienced, we really want everyone to love Feldenkrais as much as we do. And that, as far as I can tell, ain't gonna happen. because you were just the odd person that stumbled across this thing and then did the training and really just followed down the rabbit hole. And here you are. And for most people that are out in just the general public, they just simply don't know what it is. And of course, the name Feldenkrais, it's somebody's name. That word does zero work in any conversation with anybody who wants to know what it is. That word just sits there like a stone. And it very often it actually detracts because you end up having to describe his biography or his life, which is not really what the person is asking. The person wants to know, what will this thing do for me? What can I get out of it? And a savvy teacher needs to understand that. There's a way to really shape a conversation for a person that actually gets them intrigued, that engages them, that is, it makes it about their life and their desires. That was, people don't care about who Feldenkrais is, nor should they. At some point, his life story, that may become interesting to them, but leading with it is, I think, the mistake that a lot of young practitioners make. But I think what's exciting in the future is for the method to simply find a greater audience and also a different audience, to be honest. Who's our audience right now?
People in pain.
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
else? Are they young athletic people in pain?
No, they're older.
That's right. People. That's right. Yeah. If we had a community that was all interested in the data, in actually asking questions that had actual answers, like what percentage of our clients are over the age of, or it's mostly older people who are in pain. And that is a population that deserves fantastic Feldenkrais lessons and fantastic teaching. Those people should get the most amazing lessons and the most amazing experiences that they can, but so does the rest of the world. And we have to realize that the method doesn't look the same and doesn't have to look the same for a group of hard charging rugby players from Queensland, or a group of downhill skiers from British Columbia, or a group of classical pianists in Vermont. The method does not, the problem is you don't want to drag everybody to Feldenkrais Island. That's not, in my opinion, a good strategy. That island has a bunch of people on it already. And those other people you're dragging there are going to look for people that look like them. And when they don't see that, it makes them go, I don't know if this is for me. You know, if when people ask me, you know, if you were going to teach it, if you become a trainer someday, maybe I'll become a trainer someday. You know, how would you change or how would you shape a kind of a training program? And one of the ideas I've definitely thought about is I don't want to let anybody in. I don't want to let just anybody in. I don't want the open, if you can pay and you're not currently in prison, you can come into the training, right? That's kind of the current model. There is no pre-qualification, or there's no attempt to kind of homogenize the people that are in the training. And of course there are arguments, you know, but it's so welcoming. You get to meet people from all different walks of life, and the variety is, and that's all true. That's all true. But I would love to train a bunch of pianists who don't really want to be Feldenkrais teachers for anybody and anybody, but who want to use the Feldenkrais software with their piano students. That's a training program I would like to see. Now, why? Well, because one thing, they all share a fairly common vocabulary. They already know how to play the piano. They already have ideas about it. They all share a common vocabulary. That does a lot of work for that group, because then you can get to the work of actually seeing how the Feldenkrais method unpacks, reorganizes, rebuild some of the ideas they thought they had about how piano works best. And then it becomes really exciting because they're all applying it in the same domain, the same performance domain. And that is really empowering, actually. Part of what's difficult about a typical training program in terms of professional viability is, what's everybody doing? Everybody's just going out to teach lessons to anyone. Okay, that's great. That really is great. But it makes it hard for you to figure out how are you going to apply it to a particular population. And people that have a population that they're already teaching, they're very motivated to use, they want to get their hands on something that maybe helps them or informs them better about the way they understand posture. You know, most piano teachers, they don't spend a lot of time on posture. They talk about sit up straight and be here with your arm and your shoulders should be here. There's not a lot of detail to it. What do they spend a lot of time on? Hands and fingers, maybe the movement of the elbow. And they spend an enormous amount of time on music, because that's what the lessons are about, is about the music and interpreting the music, or, you know, whatever the students' issues are with where they are ready for the performance. The method has this enormous store of knowledge about how the sitting position is actually works and how it should be exploited and different ways to unpack it and practice in it, that I think most pianists would think they found Shangri-La as far as a different way into efficiency, right? And I would like to see that in terms of training programs for all kinds of professions, athletic or performing arts or pain treatment, people that are really going to work with people on walking or whatnot. That seems to me a very empowering idea, is to train a group of people to work professionally in a particular domain and not just necessarily be the great generalist, which is, of course, what Dr. Feldenkrais was. He was working with a whole bunch of different people. He was not specializing. He was not like, oh, I only work with flute players and that's how I made my name, you know.
And I really enjoyed your YouTube video, Andrew Hepp, for our listeners out there. Andrew has a great YouTube video about exactly that, for, you know, how to sit at the piano and the weight of your arms and how to play fast. And yeah, it's fantastic. So I recommend that as well.
That was fun. That was many years ago.
That's exciting. That's so exciting. It feels like that we, as practitioners, as participants in Feldenkrais, that there's potential there to really broaden the audience and broaden the engagement of what Feldenkrais actually looks like. You just began by defining Feldenkrais's effective efficiency of movement. And the person can be actually okay with what the challenges is. And then we decided to go on about more principles. And it's very important, it became very clear to us that it's very important that the students understand what is actually going on in the lesson, that you are very clear, you're very explicit in what you're teaching, rather than let it just being this sort of experience that people have and feel nice about.
That's right. I mean, my style of teaching has changed also over the years. And I would say that I've certainly become more explicit in the way that I teach. But that is because my desire for the students is not just to have an experience, not just to learn experientially, whatever that means for the person, but it's also very important that they begin to understand these. For most of my students, these are adults. Adults want to understand their experience too. This is very important to them usually. It's also very important to them being able to apply whatever has happened or whatever they think they are acquiring in the lessons. We need their intellect to actually get hooked up to their kinesthetic experience of their bodies. It's an important step. This idea is not meant that they should somehow drive themselves crazy and be somehow always calculating every little movement that they're making, but it's more that their ability to see the kinesthetic experience they're having, it needs to also engage their imagination of how it works. That's part of filling in the self-image. The self-image, I don't really know technically what it is, but the self-image is not just some movement thing. It's not just some sensation thing. It does also involve their model that they're thinking of, like, that people don't realize they have a model of walking. Now, most people will tell you, what do you mean? I have a model of walking. Most people are, if you ask them how do you walk? They'll say, well, yeah, I put one foot in front of the other. Like, right. That's your model. It's not a very sophisticated model, but it does get you from A to B. Well, there are other models of how walking works. And some of them, when you start to understand what they are and how they work and what their which ones are a little less accurate and which ones are more aspirational, which ones are more technical. Once you dig in, you actually realize, oh, I don't have to walk in this kind of crappy, disorganized way that where I've been limping on this leg, which is, oh, by the way, why I've come to the class, because this thing has been bothering me. It has something to do with your, not only the way you're functioning, but whether or not you know how to attend to the way you're functioning. And so for me, that ability for the students to understand better and to level up their understanding, that's part of progress. Progress is not you've done 10 ATM lessons. That's good. It's good. It's good. 10 is better than 2, right? And 50 is better than 10. Those are all important things. But it's also what you understand at this point. What can you actually apply? What can you show right here in the moment? Do you know now how to stand up on one leg by actually bringing the spine higher and up over the, or are you still kind of collapsing and tensing to stand on one leg? You know, this is a sort of a conversation about the person's ability to, you could say, perform better, right? But we're not talking about performance in terms of a sport or a competition. We're talking about performing in their life, having some way of actually leveling up their biological fitness, so to speak, right? And what most people are very interested in is these days, longevity. I mean, Feldenkrais is a longevity practice. It's a great practice in that it's a softer practice. It's not hard like Taekwondo or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which are fantastic, but people do get injured doing that stuff even when they do it recreationally. Feldenkrais has a much lower risk factor than those things. And it's also something that you can do well into your 70s and 80s. And it's really meant to, in my opinion, it's meant to train you for those decades, right? That's one of my goals. I want to be the guy that's 95 years old and still walking around on 2 feet. You know, that would be fantastic to just walk nicely in my last decade, you know?
That's fantastic. We're hoping the same thing, I think. Thank you so much for this amazing conversation. To me, it's really invited me as a practitioner or potential practitioner and as a student of Feldenkrais to really dig in a lot deeper. And everyone else can dig into Andrew's work. His website is The Body of Knowledge, body, ofknowledge.me. And there you can find a library of work, which is called the Body of Knowledge course. And there's different price points from what I understand. And you also do a live online class. Is that right, Andrew?
Yep. Right now we're doing, I teach 2 live lessons a week and all the lessons are recorded and you can get access to the recordings. And you don't just get access to the ones we're doing now, but depending on whatever subscription level you're at, you can have access to hundreds of other recordings that are in there. So
brilliant. Look forward to engaging with them. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you both very much. It was a lovely conversation.